Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. A reminder that we are Zooming on Thursday morning, and you know that more chaos will happen on Thursday night, but unfortunately, we'll not get to it till Monday. We begin our show every single day with a bit of political verse. We have a deadline poet named Skip Tenzer, so I'm going to ask Dave to hit it with the music.
Istanbul was Constantinople, now it's Istanbul, not Constantinople, been a long time gone. Constantinople, now it's Turkish delight on a moonlit night.
Most knew he was a serial liar, this man who played the Messiah. But his house of cards ended up in shards, and now he's a lonely pariah.
People just liked it better that way.
So take me back to Constantinople, no you can't go back to Constantinople, been a long time gone. Constantinople, why did Constantinople get the worst?
Scott Braddock, he is the voice of Texas, the dean of the Austin Press Corps, the editor of the Quorum Report. We have learned so much about Texas and so much about people like Ted Cruz, your indicted attorney general, Paxton. As I'm watching what's playing out in Washington, I feel like you prepared me in a little way by covering so much of the interesting politics of Texas.
Yes.
But with that, let me welcome Scott Braddock to the program. I so appreciate your being here.
I was trying to prepare everybody around the country for the fact that you would have a game show host or a talk show host elected as, you know, somebody to high office. And we've had that here in Texas. And I keep telling people, welcome to Texas, America. This is what our politics have become over the last couple of cycles.
One of the sort of key players and a name that keeps coming up is a Texan. And the Texan's name is Ted Cruz. So tell me how people in Texas, including the Republicans, because again, this is what Ted thinks he is genuflecting to the Republican base, but I think that there's beginning to be a new change in how that base is looking at it, because that base is fed and supplied by corporate America. And we're seeing corporate America basically pulling away dramatically with the checks that have supported the GOP, in part because of the actions of people like Ted Cruz.
Yeah. Absolutely. And, you know, there's been a lot of chatter in Texas in Republican circles and among sources I take seriously, Arnie. There have been some high level talks, I'm told, between Governor Abbott and some others about who might replace Ted Cruz in the U.S. Senate if he either quit or was expelled by the Senate. I know you've been talking a lot about the impeachment. I was actually down in the bowels of the Texas Capitol yesterday as all of the debate was happening about impeachment in Washington. Finally come back up for some air to see what's going on nationally. And the headline is, Trump impeached again. All right. It's nice to be the first at something, right? To be the record breaker. He's got the two impeachments, never happened before. If there are enough votes to impeach Trump in the Senate to do the entire removal from office, and as you have so ably pointed out, and to prevent him from ever running for federal office again, which is, it sounds like the end game for Republican leadership, at least with McConnell right now. He'd like to excise this from the Republican Party. If that's true, if they have enough votes for that, well, then there are enough votes in the U.S. Senate to also remove the most punchable face in the Senate, which is Ted Cruz. And that's from his own colleagues, not from me. You look at what role he played along with Josh Hawley in that riot. And look, let's be clear here. He had a role in the riot. President Trump had a role in the riot. Hawley had a role in the riot. Inciting the riot is not about sharp rhetoric. I had somebody call me the other day, a very good friend of mine, a conservative talk show host from the Rio Grande Valley, who's been in Republican politics in Texas for many years. And he said, Scott, you know, I listened to the speech that President Trump gave there, you know, near the Capitol, and I didn't hear anything in there that was specifically inciting a riot. He talked about walking down to the building. He talked about fighting this to the end and all that sort of stuff. And I have to say, Arnie, look, it's not that he used any specific words in that speech. This is letting people get away with something. It's not that specific words were used or that sharp rhetoric was used. It's that Trump and his allies, including Cruz, are spreading this lie for months after the election, that the election was stolen, that there was all this malfeasance, that there was fraud. More than 60 court cases have been thrown out, including by judges who were appointed by President Trump himself, and that's still not good enough for the people who support President Trump. It is a cult of personality. I have seen in Texas, which is a rock-rib Republican state, as we have established here once again in the 2020 election, where Republicans holding on to the Texas House and every statewide office, even though there was a lot of talk about all that, you know, it's still a state where the Republican primary is the election of consequence. I saw a lot of Republicans here. This is just anecdotal, but pulling back on Wednesday of last week and saying, whoa, is this what they're really supporting in Washington? That people would ransack the Capitol and it comes to violence over this guy? I mean, I'll tell you, Arnie, for a lot of the conservatives out there in this state, they feel like they've already gotten what they need to get from President Trump. And you may have noticed this around the country, but with our Texas evangelicals in particular, Dr. Robert Jeffress from First Baptist in Dallas, I think John Hagee also down in San Antonio, these big ministers, they've gotten what they wanted. They got all these federal judges who are conservatives who have reshaped the courts for a generation, right? They put all these young federal justices and judges on the bench, including at the Supreme Court level. They were some of the first ones to move away. There, I was told yesterday by a friend in Dallas, there's a billboard along the freeway in Big D that says, what do you do for, not, this is pretty close, it was paraphrased, what do you do for President Biden? You should pray for him, you know, as a Christian. And that billboard was purchased by First Baptist Dallas, where the pastor is Robert Jeffress, who's been one of the biggest supporters of President Trump. You also saw our Lieutenant Governor, Dan Patrick, who continues to make these comments like, you know, the election was hijacked and, you know, there was some malfeasance for sure. But in this exact same speech yesterday, when Dan Patrick was saying that, then he said, but I'm not one of those who says that it was stolen. So he's hijacked. He's saying it's hijacked, but it's not stolen. I don't even know what that means. He's trying to have it both ways. It's not the first time I've seen both sides of his mouth have words come out of them. And here you have somebody who has been inciting people as well, telling people that there was, you know, some cheating, there was massive fraud in the election. Dan Patrick is the one who offered $1 million for any evidence of fraud. And of course, you had the lieutenant governor in Pennsylvania say that he wanted his $1 million in gas station cards because they did find a guy in Pennsylvania who had set it up such that it looked like his dead mother had voted for President Trump. So on and on and on with the lying about all this. With Ted Cruz, it is discussed all around. Let me read just one thing from the former lieutenant governor of Texas, David Dewhurst, a Republican. He put out a statement after the riot and said, quote, I am disappointed with Senator Cruz and Senator Josh Hawley, who stood out as the definition of self-focused individuals who exacerbated the fragile situation between the protesters and the Capitol Police, which could have taken even more lives. He said, Cruz and Hawley should be censured. It's pretty strong language for a Republican. And then you look at what some of the Republicans in our delegation to Congress said about this. Texans had some of the harshest words for President Trump in the impeachment proceedings yesterday as he was being declared an insurrectionist, an aspiring tyrant. Some of the Democrats from Texas, including Joaquin Castro of San Antonio, he said, quote, Donald Trump is the most dangerous man ever to occupy the Oval Office. If inciting a deadly insurrection is not enough to get a president impeached, then what is? Now, you expect that from a Democrat who is one of the floor managers for this, right? For one of the impeachment managers. Our Republicans were critical as well, even though they voted against it. One in particular, Michael McCaul, said, and I'm paraphrasing, I don't have his quote in front of me, but it struck me yesterday. He put out a statement and said, the distinct possibility that evidence will come out to show I'm on the wrong side of this issue when I cast my vote today. We had other Republicans step up and say that absolutely President Trump probably did things that are impeachable, but they argued that the specific articles of impeachment that were in front of them were flawed. So it's not like he got, I mean, look, they did vote in partisan fashion, Arnie, but it's not as if he was getting a pass even from those Republicans, which I think probably gives some cover to the Senate Republicans, who instead of representing small gerrymandered districts around the state, those senators who represent entire states where millions of people voted for both Joe Biden and President Trump, those senators have a little more cover to be able to support this stuff when it makes its way to the upper chamber.
Well, you were talking about Ted Cruz. I want to go back to Dan Patrick. He's becoming my favorite, you know, focus of conversation. Dan Patrick belongs to a group known as the Republican Attorney General's Association.
Ken Paxton.
They have a 501c4.
Slow down, Arnie. Ken Paxton does.
Oh, Ken Paxton. I'm sorry. Yeah. Ken Paxton. I apologize. Ken Paxton is, I keep getting the two of them mixed up.
His name is right there on the indictment. You just have to read it.
Okay, it's right there. Anyway, so Ken Paxton is part of the Republican Attorney General's Association. They did robocall in order to encourage people to show up on January 6th. They are now finding out that they are now losing, just the way Donald Trump and some of the Republican members of Congress and the United States Senate are finding out that corporate America is taking the money away. Guess what? Money is being taken away from the Republican Attorney General's Association because of their involvement in, frankly, the insurrection. Are we going to see Ken Paxton suffering any kind of negative consequences? Because he has been front and center with Donald Trump the entire time. He didn't even fudge like Dan Paxton.
Look, Paxton has some sort of charm, Arnie. I don't know what it is. He has been indicted. You know, that was 5 years ago. We're going on 6 years of him being indicted for securities fraud. More recently, he was accused by his top staff, conservative staffers at the Texas Attorney General's office, who accused him of bribery and abuse of office, among, quote, other crimes. And he still continues to, you know, go down this path, including those who made the accusation. Top staffers quit from his office. Those folks cannot be called liberal by any stretch of the imagination. One of the folks who accused him of bribery is a guy named Jeff Mateer, who, after quitting the Attorney General's office, went back to his old job at a group called Liberty First. And their entire focus, and they do a few other things, but the main thing they do is work to try to get conservative justices and judges put on the federal bench. These are rock rib Attila the Hun conservatives who are accusing the Attorney General of bribery. So this is his only card to play, is this sort of genuflection to this president who is on his way out and is still the main cause of the Republican right at this point, though. Here's the question, Arnie. When will this fever break? And I think Van Jones, you know, the former Obama administration official who's always on CNN, he put it very well the other day when we saw this insurrection at the Capitol, when you saw the violence there, and you see some of the things that some Republicans are still saying about it as far as defending the president. Is this the beginning of something, or is this the end of something? Is this the beginning of what the Republican base is going to look like going forward into the years, into the future? If so, in Texas, then Ken Paxton, the Attorney General, is positioning himself correctly. If the November election doesn't matter, as my publisher, Harvey Kronberg, has often said, neither side puts their best foot forward when the general election doesn't matter. If it's only the primary, then you see people playing to the base, and you see Ken Paxton playing to the Donald Trump supporters. Is this durable? Are we going to see the Republican base continue to be so focused on this and so focused on this idea, this lie that President Trump, he was cheated out of the election? If they are, then Ken Paxton is golden in 2 years when he would run for reelection. If they kind of move on, they forget about it and it has to be about other things, then I think some other Republican might be able to challenge him for that office. And in the meantime, who knows, he might go to the federal penitentiary.
You mentioned that the Texas legislature is now convened.
Yeah.
So one of the things that you sent me, which I thought was just, I almost chuckled, was that a new speaker was sworn in and immediately embraces bipartisanship.
Yep.
And calls third party groups, something that you and I are now both very familiar with, Empower Texans as selfies. Now, I want you to sort of talk a little bit about what happened with the speaker, but remind everyone about Empower Texans, because it actually also involves you, Mr. Braddock. Mm-hmm.
Well, Empower Texans, I've been working for going on 8 years now trying to expose this group. It's a right-wing enforcement group. It's funded mostly by probably a billionaire from, we don't know his exact net worth, but a wealthy guy from Midland, Texas, named Tim Dunn, who is the chairman of the group. And they have spent millions and millions of dollars to elect or defeat candidates in elections over the last decade or so. The last Speaker of the House, Dennis Bonin, he was sort of the placeholder, I guess, between Joe Strauss and who we have now, Dade Phelan, who I'll talk about in a second. Your listeners are pretty familiar with who Joe Strauss is at this point. We've talked about him for years. But Dennis Bonin wanted to broker a peace deal, if you will, between mainstream Republicans and these right-wing enforcement groups. And so he invited Empower Texans into the Speaker's office of the Texas Capitol. This happened in 2019. He wanted to basically cut a deal where the right-wing groups could spend money against certain Republicans. If they just wouldn't spend money against other Republicans, then Bonin would do things for them, including let them continue their charade of pretending to be legitimate media, to be news outlets. And this is one of the insidious things, Arnie, is these 501c3, 501c4, and political action committees pretending to be journalists. And look, in America, the government doesn't decide who's a journalist. But you can draw a bright line between those groups that spend money in elections, direct expenditures, versus, you know, the newspaper in your town or the television station. They don't do that. And you know, at Quorum Report, we don't do that. and it's fine to be politically engaged, and it's fine to do your own form of journalism, but to say those are exactly the same is BS. One of the things that Dennis Bonin, the former speaker, was going to do for Empower Texans was offer them media credentials so that they could be on the floor of the Texas House as the House was doing its deliberations. Think about how corrosive that is to democracy, Arnie, that you would have, and you know, nobody's naive around here. Of course, they're going to continue to spend millions of dollars to try to elect and defeat folks. But when they're actually deliberating the laws that we all have to live under, how sick is it that the people who are spending that cash would literally be on the floor of the House with them, looking them in the eye as they're voting? That's the sickness of it, okay? And that's what the former speaker was offering. He also offered to take away my media credential because Empower Texans hates me. That's a short version of that. All of this conversation was recorded by the third party group, which of course is just a bunch of snakes and wanted to throw him right under the bus. And they released the recording and now he flamed out. He was only a one-term speaker. It's just fascinating. So in the meantime, the Texas House kind of felt snake bit. You know, they kind of have some PTSD from going through this. This new speaker in 2019 was supposed to be the bipartisan guy. He was supposed to be somebody who rejected these third party groups. And now they have chosen a new speaker, a guy from Beaumont, Texas, from the Golden Triangle, from the coast of Texas. His name is Dade Phelan. Interesting name. Phelan, Dade Phelan. He's a devout Catholic. He has four little boys. He's a bipartisan sort of guy. He started his career in politics as a staffer for a Democratic representative from the Beaumont area. Remember, years ago, all those areas in Texas were Democratic. That's who you'd have to work for. But he also worked for some Republicans as well. He gave his his sort of inaugural speech in the Texas House this week, and a couple of things. One, he talked about bipartisanship not being a bad thing. In the Texas House, unlike other legislatures and certainly unlike Washington, there is still this tradition of bipartisan cooperation and power sharing. It's not just talk. Democrats run serious committees in the Texas House.
Incredible.
This is something that they don't do in other states. You don't do that in New Hampshire, right? Who's ever in charge is in charge, right? Whichever side. All patronage. We don't do that here. Democrats have a say in the legislative process. It's an acknowledgement of a few things. One, it's just the tradition of the Texas House that this has always been done. When Democrats were in charge, they shared power with Republicans. Republicans have shared power with Democrats. Two, it's an acknowledgement that this Texas is like its own little country, right? I mean, we say come and take it in Texas the way that you say live free or die in New Hampshire. This is a state of 30 million people spread across 254 counties, two time zones. You can't run everything in partisan fashion. That won't work. And you can't micromanage everything out of Austin. That won't work. We have too many diverse communities. And all of those people, the 150 members of the Texas House, they're all representing communities, whether they're Republican or Democrat, liberal, moderate, conservative. We've got every shade of all of that. Whatever stripe you would assign them politically, every one of their communities is different. Every one of their communities has something that is unique and a challenge that needs to be addressed and the state government needs to tackle in a lot of these cases, or that state government needs to leave alone and let the folks in their local community deal with it. And so there is that respect. And so Phelan talked about that. He talked about the idea that in the House, they'll respect each other as Republicans and Democrats and respect the communities that they all serve. And then he also said there are these third-party groups which are, quote, selfish and only act in their own interest. And I'm paraphrasing now, but he said basically those groups are not going to knock the Texas House off of its game, not going to knock them off course. So that was something that these folks wanted to hear. And I will say that what he's doing is a similar thing to what McConnell was doing when he was talking about the need to go ahead and honor the traditions and follow the law and certify the election of Joe Biden. That subtext of McConnell's speech was that he would protect his Republican members when they get attacked for this in primaries, right? That he'll send them money and resources. When Phelan, our new speaker in Texas, when he takes direct aim at these third-party groups that will be challenging Republican members in the primary, what he's saying to them is, as the leader who's going to be in charge of the leadership fund of millions and millions of dollars, I'll have your back when these third-party groups come after you next year in your primary, which you know they're going to do, Arnie. The cycle repeats itself.
Then you went on to say that the Texas Senate cuts Democrats out of the equation when it comes to what legislation will be passed. So we have this bifurcated situation. you see something more kumbaya, I have your back, you're going to participate. Describe the headset of the Texas Senate.
The outbreak of bipartisanship didn't get too far, Arnie. In the Texas Senate, the lieutenant governor, and I don't know if it works this way in New Hampshire, is the lieutenant governor have anything to do with the state Senate? You don't even have one.
You don't even have one.
It's different in every state, right? The lieutenant governor in a lot of states doesn't barely even matter, right? Maybe they act as the, in some places I know they act as the governor when the governor's out of town or stuff like that. In Texas, the lieutenant governor is very powerful. The Texas lieutenant governor is the presiding officer of the Texas Senate. Some people would ask, they would come from different states or different events, and people would ask me, well, isn't that like a separation of powers thing that you would have? But the Texas lieutenant governor is not part of the governor's administration at all. They don't run together. They run separately. So the presiding officer of the Texas Senate basically is the guy who at the front of the room recognizes and calls on the different senators to be able to move their legislation forward. You know, in these legislative bodies, they have a calendar and they go by the calendar and they, you know, they go down the list of legislation that they're going to pass. The lieutenant governor in Texas is the calendar in the Senate. He decides which bills that they're going to take up. In the Texas Senate, for decades, going back to the 70s and before that, it's the 60s, there was a rule, and it's just a rule, it's not the law, but it's a very important one. In the Texas Senate, it would take 2/3 of the senators present to be able to even consider a bill on the floor for debate before they could even move it forward. And what this did was it created consensus across this huge state of 30 million people with so many different interests. It's not just Republican and Democrat. It's urban versus rural and suburban. It's Texas Tech versus Texas A&M. It's UT versus the Aggies. Sometimes it's Houston versus Dallas. Lots of different points of tension. They need to reach consensus. You need to be able to go talk to the other members of the Senate and try to get them on board with what you're trying to do and make your case for that first before you move it to the floor for debate. And as the Dean of the Senate, John Whitmire from Houston, has often said, no piece of legislation is perfect. So if you go talk to your colleagues and they say, well, you know, I could support that bill if you made this little change or this little tweak, that will improve it before it even gets to the floor for debate. Dan Patrick made it a cause of his when he was a talk show host, then as a state senator, and now as lieutenant governor. He made it a cause that he was going to get rid of the 2/3 rule in the Texas Senate, because what his argument was, look, Republicans are in charge now, and Republicans should be, you know, making the calls on everything. We should just steamroll the Democrats on everything. Not understanding or not caring, I think he understands it, not caring that not everything is partisan. When he became lieutenant governor in 2015, the threshold was lowered at his behest from 2/3 down to 60%. So once Democrats won some more seats, he needed to change the rules again. The old operating procedure was that there were 19 Republicans, and so they could move forward with whatever they wanted to do under the rules as he had set them up. Late last year, he indicated he would push forward to change the rule from 19 senators to move legislation forward to 18 senators. The only rationale for that, Arnie, is that there would be 18 Republican senators this session. Just yesterday, just this week, the Senate debated this, and they did change it from 19 senators down to 18 senators, which, again, is just changing the – that's a lot of words to just say this. That, as we say down here, that's taking the long country road to just say this, that the rule was changed just to conform to the size of the majority. Which is a real bastardization of the process. That's not the way that it's supposed to work. Democrats had made the argument. They are gaining steam. They did pick up a seat in the Texas Senate in this last election. Are they going to change the rule again if Democrats continue to move toward a majority in the Texas Senate out of the 31 senators? And then what will happen? What will Democrats be in position to do when they take the majority? Remember, it was Harry Reid, the Democratic leader, who changed the rules in the U.S. Senate to conform to the majority. And then what happened later? Republicans have now excoriated the Democrats for changing that, because now they have every justification for doing a lot of what they're doing, at least from the procedural standpoint.
We have not even mentioned it, but I have to. So where did Donald Trump go but to Texas this week? So before, you only have 2 minutes, but that's more than enough time to talk about it. Talk to me a little bit about Trump's visit to Texas.
He went to Alamo, Texas, which is not the Alamo. It's a small community it's about 200 miles, I think, from San Antonio, where the actual Alamo is. he was there to basically, people were on his side. His supporters were saying that this is a victory lap. He's talking about the progress on the border wall. There wasn't a whole lot of news out of it, Arnie. I didn't, even in Texas, which is interesting, when you have the president of the United States come to Texas and it's not a giant story everywhere. He was, you know, back in Washington, they were too busy impeaching him. And we still have, you know, an economy that's recovering and we have the pandemic raging all around us. Photo ops aren't making the big news that they used to around here.
Wow. So how is Dan Patrick doing with COVID? What's happening in your state? Again, we haven't mentioned COVID. That's what's so raging now that it's even more highly contagious. How is Texas doing?
Well, there is now testing for COVID at the Texas Capitol, which he is insisting on. Patrick actually made some comments just yesterday saying testing is the answer until we have, you know, the vaccine evenly distributed across the state and the country. He's probably on the right side of that, but you may remember last year, this is the same guy who said to Tucker Carlson on Fox News Channel that elderly folks should at least be given the option of exposing themselves to COVID-19 for the sake of moving the economy forward. But when it comes to himself, when it comes to what's good for Dan Patrick, which is proximity to power, the people who are coming into the Texas Capitol, he wants to make sure that none of them have COVID-19.
So is it just testing, or are they also requiring mask wearing?
Mask wearing throughout the Capitol, except on the Texas Senate floor, where he's the presiding officer. The senators were not required to wear their masks. The rest of the day, Arnie, they're going to figure out the rules of the Texas House, and I expect at least some debate after we get off the air here among the House of Representatives as to whether they have to wear masks on the floor of the Texas House. It's not uniform throughout the Texas Capitol.
Stay healthy, social distance, wear a mask. I love you, Scott Braddock, and keep us posted on the insanity of Texas as we watch what's going on in the Capitol as well. Anyway, we'll talk to you next week. Ciao. Be safe.
Thanks, Arnie. Talk soon.
All right. This is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Jay Scott and Stephanie Collins. Stick around. We'll be right back with Bill Kern.
Insight Daily Radio.
From food to fashion, science to tech talk, or for just plain fun, we've got you covered. From the art of all things, here's Lasana Jeffries.
Do you sit in an office chair or on a couch for more than 6 hours a day? Then here are some disturbing facts. Your risk of heart disease has increased by up to 64%. You're shaving off 7 years of quality life. You're also more at risk for certain types of cancer. Simply put, sitting is killing you. And that's the bad news. But the good news? It's easy to counteract no matter how lazy you are. Start with this. Remember to stand once an hour and get about 30 minutes of moderate activity per day. We usually tell people moderate activity is equivalent to a brisk walk. This would include yard work or cleaning your house, anything that gets you moving. This isn't about working out, which is positive in its own right, but doesn't counteract the effects of long periods of sitting. It's about creating pockets of moderate activity throughout the day and giving your body a respite from sitting. Of course, couch potatoes and office workers don't always have 30 minutes to spare. So here's the good news. You can break that up into 30 minutes throughout the day, so 10-minute segments. The main reason you want to shoot for the 10-minute chunks is because you're creating a mini stress in your body that helps increase your endurance. In the real world, this means you won't get tired halfway up the stairs. Think of it this way. You don't train for a marathon by sprinting for 10 minutes every day. Instead, you increase your endurance with longer jogs. Thanks for listening. I'm Lisanna Jeffries.
Insight Daily Radio.
Oh! Welcome back to part two of the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Again, a reminder that we are Zooming on Thursday morning, and you know something will happen Thursday night. We'll be discussing it probably on Monday. Every Friday, we get the wonderful opportunity of hanging out with Bill Curry. Bill Curry is a progressive voice. He is a voice filled with honesty and facts and ethics and has a great moral compass. Plus, he actually ran for governor of Connecticut twice, was part of the nuclear freeze movement, has written for Salon.com. And after this unbelievable week, Bill, unbelievable. I mean, when you think about it, a week ago and a day Wednesday, we were watching a lynch mob assault the Capitol. Exactly 1 week later, Bill Curry, we were watching them have this impeachment trial, and it was methodical and organized, and people knew they got this many minutes and that. It was the same location. It was the same place as we saw what had happened the week before. And it's kind of mind-blowing that as they are attempting to take over the Capitol 7 days before that, they're now moving forward on impeaching the president of the United States for the second time. So just visually, it was for me something that made me think, oh my God, we are being so whiplashed in this country. So let me first welcome you to the program. How are you?
In context, pretty good.
So as I'm talking about this whiplash, I decided, of course, before I get on the air with you and with Scott Braddock, I'm going to turn on Morning Joe. So I'm going to start with
There was your first mistake, but go ahead.
Exactly. My anger of the moment. So here was the panel discussion talking about Joe Biden taking over and how we are going to see the reestablishment of big government. All right. And I'm like, shut up. And all the liberals and Democrats are like nodding their head. Nobody believes. I don't believe in big corporations. I believe in responsible government. I believe in a responsive government. I know how I live my life. I don't write checks just to write a check. I actually recycle. I actually go to thrift stores. I take stuff off the side of the road and I repurpose it. Why would I live a life that assumes that the kind of government that I would embrace would be one that basically writes checks with no accountability? Do you know who likes big government? The Republican Party. Because it turns out that it's their special interests that adore big government. It means they don't pay taxes. It means they get additional credits and benefits. It means that they don't get regulations. It means that they don't have responsibility. And there I am watching all the Democrats, in air quotes, basically nodding their head about the need for big government. How do we wash their mouth out with soap? It isn't about big. It is about responsible, and it is about responsive.
First of all, with a little bit more care taken on our side of the equation, again, watching the presidential primary debates in 2020, it was a constant fiscal and cultural bidding war. It wasn't, for the kind of progressivism that attracts me, it wasn't about changing enough rules about the distribution of power, income, wealth, and opportunity at the very core of the society. It wasn't about the democratization of the economy part of our political economy. But it was about mostly legitimate cultural issues. Some weren't. Kamala Harris bringing up mandatory busing, a topic no one had mentioned to me in 40 years until that evening, didn't help a lot. She realized that and 3 days later decided she wasn't for it either. There were moments of Beto O'Rourke saying he was actually going to go in and confiscate guns. You bet we're going to take them away. You know, just all it was a temperature raising. You know, that's not going to happen. We have a dozen or so gun reforms we can get. And I hope the Democrats show their good faith on this now. That kind of policy is not on the table. They're usually establishment Democrats who take the furthest out cultural issues because they haven't shown bravery on a living wage. They haven't shown bravery on Medicare for all. They haven't shown bravery on corruption in government at all. They're the problem, not the solution. And so they reach for these sort of theatrical cultural gestures, some of which are right, some of which aren't good ideas, and none of which try to lead, by the way, you have to lead in cultural issues, which is with great respect and care and dialogue with the people you're asking to accept change. Yeah. And so they don't do that. And then on top of it, they do this fiscal bidding war. You're only going to spend $3 trillion on climate change. I'll see your $3 trillion and I'll raise you $3 trillion. And the person out there never gets, because all we do now is sound bites and memes and slogans on our side. We don't make arguments. This showed up terribly, I thought, yesterday. But because we do that, we don't explain. There's not enough explain. And it's also, I would lastly say, it's the things that don't require a larger government or more spending in the public sector that usually make the most difference. A public option is a huge money saver. The government spends less money when you get universal health care or as close to it as you can. Medicare for All saves even more money. Making a living wage with an inflation adjustment, that doesn't cost the government really hardly anything, but it changes the rules of the society, taxes, et cetera. So they don't do enough on those things that need to be changed. Even climate change, by the way, there's a lot that has to be spent. It's mostly about changing rules, not writing checks. If we were clearer and stronger about the fundamental rules we need to change, then we'd win this debate more often. We have to show that we care about it. And the other thing is that it goes to the fact that if you're only ready with abstractions, if you're not ready with specificity and detail and example, if you're not ready with logic, if you're not ready with facts, you're going to lose. That's how they argue sometimes, although they're better at making detailed, logical, factual arguments than we are, and they're lying. They're lying, and they're still better at it than we are. We really need to up our game in order to do that. And that means getting people who are pundits and politicians who are capable of more than those abstractions. The kind of people end up on Morning Joe don't know enough policy to talk specifically. And they've been hanging around in those sort of really kind of corrupted power circles for so long. They are completely out of touch with the real needs and aspirations of the working middle class and of the poor in the United States.
Well, the example, for example, of raising the minimum wage to $15 or to a livable wage, what that is about basically saying to the Walmarts and to a number of the low-wage employers that we're not going to provide welfare for you. And so that's welfare for corporate America. If you don't raise the minimum wage so people can pay for their own food, so people can pay for their own housing, so people can pay for their own medical care, then guess what? Government then needs to step in to fill that financial gap. Well, that's an employer's responsibility. An employer needs to make sure that the people they hire can live, eat, sleep, and go to a doctor when they're sick. And if they're not, then I am providing the difference in that paycheck. And who is benefiting by that difference? But the corporation. And again, that's welfare for corporations. It isn't subsidizing poor people. It's subsidizing rich corporations. And again, that most people want to earn their living. They don't want to have to basically genuflect and figure out when they get their food stamps or whether they're on Section 8 housing or how long they have to wait so they can find an affordable place to live. They want to be able to buy their food and pick where they live. That's what they would like to do. But when you're earning $9 an hour, you don't survive. You don't survive. And that means that government needs to step in to make it possible for you to be somewhat whole. And again, that's why it's not about raising the minimum wage. It's about stopping benefiting companies that aren't paying people enough to live on.
Yes.
That's God.
By the way, you don't have to worry. I don't know where Joe Manchin, the famous avatar of Democratic conservatism, from the senator from West Virginia, stands on a living wage. I do know where the people of West Virginia stand, okay? They're for it, all right? Yeah. And so they may hate socialism. I haven't seen the numbers, but lots of people do. Who knows? Socialism's a word. It's easy to hate words, okay? But a couple of things they would definitely be for, by a wide margin, according to all polling data I've seen, are a living wage and a strong public option, one that really went after the problem of for-profit insurance industries, one in which all public employees were in the public option and not buying their insurance from for-profit agencies, et cetera. But the kinds of changes you need to make to create the next best thing to a single-payer system, which would, I think, undermine the for-profit model in about a year and get us to where we go, especially if you bring in the Obama. Again, there's a distinction. We just don't stop to make any detailed distinctions. People didn't want to be pushed off their own health care that they have now. The only reason being, not because they love insurance companies, but because they're afraid, and because we were asking them to be forced into a system we hadn't built yet. They couldn't kick the tires on it. It doesn't exist. But everybody's for a public option, and nobody's really screamed that much about the Obama 4% of people who weren't involved. The Republican litigation opposing it centered on the fact that we were forcing them to join private companies at exorbitant rates. But if you had a public option, you have to go out and buy policies you can't afford from companies that overcharge. If we put a 4% on the people who aren't otherwise insured, rather than telling the people who are they have to move, we would then get everybody insured the next morning. We wouldn't start with Medicare for all, but we would start with universal insurance. How about that?
Given the pandemic, the huge new spike, for example, in unemployment, which by what did I see? Did I see a statistic that said virtually every person, all the new people that were unemployed were women? I mean, I think I saw something about the connection. I think if I went into West Virginia, Joe Manchin's home, and say, do you think it's smart that if you lose your job, you lose your health insurance?
Yeah, they'd say
None of them would. And that's the question that people need to ask now. Should you lose your job and then lose your health insurance, especially because of the pandemic, especially because we now know that people that contracted COVID are going to be long haulers and are going to have it, especially because people die of cancer and are in car accidents or get sick or strep throat. And now suddenly, if you're no longer employed at the restaurant or you're no longer employed at the ski area, you don't have access to healthcare. Does that make any sense? And it has nothing to do with, not that you weren't a good restaurant worker or a good, you know, ski lift operator. It's that because of the pandemic, we've all been shaken with our relationship to our employer.
The vast majority of the uninsured are the self-employed and small businesses and the young. A public option that required the young to join and offered the small businesses and the self-employed also, they would have to join something, but a way in to a system that cost less, that delivered the promise of that was never kept in the Affordable Health Care Act, was that it didn't make healthcare more affordable to almost anyone. We subsidized the price, but we didn't bring the price down. So if you were up to that 70,000, yes, you could get declining subsidies at 60,000, pardon me. You could get a declining subsidies from the government to continue paying the insurance companies for work they weren't really doing, for value they weren't contributing.
Right.
You could do that, but you couldn't bring the price down for the whole society, for the small businesses. And if you were over that $58,000 and still didn't have $1,000 a month for healthcare, and you wouldn't, you were stuck. So we have to make the Affordable Health Care Act really affordable. And that requires the kind of vast expansion that both Biden and Obama agreed to fall short of in their work. We need to go further than the public option that was on the table from Pelosi in 2010. And restore the rest of Obamacare, and above all, expand Medicaid. If we do those things, we will have universal health care in America. And everybody can take the ideological abstractions and debate them till the cows come home. It won't matter. People will be happy.
So let's talk a little bit about, obviously, yesterday. Again, we're Zooming on Thursday morning, and yesterday was the impeachment in the House of Representatives. But more importantly, you wanted to talk about something that I think is also interesting. Did what we see happen on the 6th of January, was that an insurrection or was that a coup? And you said it's important for us to sort of define terms and to actually apply the terms to different parties, because some people may have been involved in an insurrection and others may actually have been involved in a coup. And it could happen simultaneously, all right? I think this is a brilliant way of understanding what we've been seeing, not just on the 6th, but what we've been seeing for the last 2 or 3 or 4 years.
Let me say, and this is about the larger question of the debate we were having over impeachment, over the insurrection. We've just been talking about healthcare. We don't need members of Congress who are better sloganeers. We sure could use somebody who'd won a moot court contest somewhere along the line, who was better at adducing facts into evidence and better at applying logic to the facts. And it starts with this discussion on our side. Again, I don't care about the Republican mistakes. I can't cure them. And many of these people are irretrievable, frankly. It would be nice if we came in and did a better job of making arguments, and almost it would be nice. It is indispensable for us to start making stronger public arguments for our positions. And just a couple of things I'll point out about this argument that killed me watching it yesterday. It is important to separate between a coup and an insurrection, because the rioters were in an insurrection and the Republican members of Congress were involved in a coup. And it's just remember, there are two different things here. And this should have been brought up 100 times yesterday.
Yes.
That the Republicans in that room opposing impeachment were involved in a subversion. You had to look them in the eye. They sit and they criticize the character of the Democrats all day long in every debate I watched for the last decade. Okay, ad hominem attacks are their bread and butter. And we have to get up and say, just say the somewhat uncomfortable truths. And that includes the fact that the real coup here, you can debate, you can bring in a sociologist or political scientist and talk about the difference between an insurrection and a coup and a push and what makes one and the other. Most of that debate was also unhelpful, but seeing that there was without a doubt a coup being performed by the Republican Party as a whole, not in the Senate, it broke down for them in the Senate in terms of the actual coup at the end. They flirted with the coup for 2 months. They began to realize the hot water they were in. One, they realized how much hot water they were getting into as this went on. And two, they hated Trump. So they didn't want a coup for Trump. Coup has to have a leader. The House members were really still devoted to Trump in whatever way, for whatever reason. So they wanted one. But that was a coup. That was an unconstitutional attempt to overturn the democratic will of the country, to replace democratic mechanisms with autocratic mechanisms, and to reelect a dictator. That's what that was. The insurrection was just a riot for which lots of them should go to jail. And you could argue parts of the people out there were coups. Parts of people out there thought they were coming to overthrow the government. Most of them thought they were coming there to knock over a statue and take a selfie. Who cares? A lot of them were brutal. You know, there's a huge number of people in that crowd. Not a few bad apples, but I mean a whole orchard of bad apples in that crowd who need to be tracked down. And so far as we have the room, put in jail. So there were two things that had to be made. One was about who was in the coup, and the Republicans had to have it explained to them. And every single transaction, you are still enabling a coup because you're lying. And that was the other major theme. And it came up once in a while, but no one turned and said, you want to bring us all together? Stop lying.
God, why didn't anyone say that yesterday? You know, I cannot believe that I am.
Just stop lying. Get up, stand up from your desk right now and admit that this was a free and fair election. You don't have to tell your base you lied. You can tell them you were misinformed. You can tell them you were reckless. You can say whatever you want. But above all, if you even just want to say, gee whiz, I was mistaken. But stand up right now. You don't want reconciliation. You want a cover up. Okay, that's what you're asking for. A cover-up is no way. That's why they call them, you know, truth and reconciliation commissions, because the reconciliation part follows the truth part. And, you know, as I once, if you may remember, I was interviewing Bob Woodward at a panel a couple years ago, and I asked him if he thought the American people still cared enough about the truth to impeach a president for not telling it. And he demurred. But I think it's a really important question. It reflects our entire culture's relative uninterest in the assumption of responsibility and the telling of the truth. And so we had that chance.
We do.
We had that chance on the floor. I'm hoping the Senate, that someone will get to these people. One, we had to talk about where the coup was. Two, we had to talk about the fact that what enabled all this violence, first and foremost, was constant propaganda.
Yes.
You were attempting a coup, and this kind of divisive, heated, violent language, whether you told them to kill anybody, the language was larded down with violence. And nobody really made that case. I mean, on our side. And instead, everybody got to make a 30-second ad for their own indignation. Yes. The same thing we do every time. They treated these speaking spots as if they were rewards for party loyalty.
Right. And let me just say something, Bill. All we kept hearing from the Republicans was unity, unity, unity. And nobody actually turned to them to talk about that. No one responded to that garbage.
But partly because, by the way, I wondered again, and this reminds me, you see this all the time, and the best example was the Kavanaugh hearings. In yesterday's debate over impeachment was exactly like the Kavanaugh hearing. The Republicans came in, Christine Blasey Ford comes in the morning and gives what I thought was very compelling testimony that raised a lot of very serious issues. Again, I think the Democrats should have not just focused on that. They should have focused on the easily provable lies that Kavanaugh had been telling throughout his career and the fact that he was a corrupt political apparatchik. But they were doing the same thing. And when they came in the afternoon, after the Ford testimony, Lindsey Graham, the Republican, spent the rest of the day talking about the process.
Right.
And focused on the fact that the octogenarian Senator Feinstein didn't know whether someone in her staff had leaked, you know, as if leaking was the great mortal sin of Washington. You know, leaking is, you know, right up there with just regular phone calls as the primary means of communication in that town. OK, Okay. Everybody's there has leaked 1,000 times. And they actually were able to create the impression in a mere 4 hours that whether somebody in a Capitol Hill office had leaked a story was more important than whether the nominee had committed a rape.
Right.
And they were able to switch topics. And the thing that the Democrats needed to do was to watch the process, and they needed to defend themselves at every
point. And they never did.
And they never did. It was the same thing yesterday. They let all those attacks on their own character and all those phony attacks in the process and the continued lying just pass by. They were talking about Trump, the Democrats, because that's what someone told them to do. And so that's what they were prepared. It was the one thing they were prepared for, was to make, you know, remarks about Trump, unexplained, undocumented, but, you know, protestations of their own virtuous indignation. Well, the Republicans came in there to discredit them.
Yes.
And they just let them do it all day. And so we have to realize that you have to bell the cat. You have to identify the process, because their process is always the same, lying.
Well, but
you have to stop and you have to identify it.
And as you point out, you want unity? Tell the truth.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So every time they talk unity, when you start sharing the facts and you start believing the truth, and
that's
you
right.
know that this is a free and fair election.
You get up here today and tell us that you're never going to try to overturn the will of the people again, and that the truth of this election was that it was fairer and more efficient than most that we've known in our lives under extremely difficult circumstances, then I don't know, maybe we don't have to impeach. If you can get Trump to join you in it, maybe we can all go home. That's how important I think the truth is. If you'll help establish it, I'll help you unify. But do not walk into these hallowed halls that still have bullet holes in them from 1 week ago from your guy and continue to lie and ask me to get together with you. Do not think that we're going to just walk away and help you cover up a coup that your entire party and almost its every aspect participated in.
Right. And so you talk about corruption a lot. And you talk about the fact that we have to deal with corruption. There's now a question about whether they should actually go forward with the trial in the Senate. Obviously, Joe Biden wants to focus on the pandemic and he wants to focus on the economy. And he doesn't want Donald Trump to be the headline as he's trying to sort of re-engage the country. I heard this phenomenal analogy, and I think I shared it with you last night. I'm going to share it again. You have a huge wound in your arm, and you know that it needs to be stitched. Do you go and stitch the arm, or do you disinfect and clean out the wound before you stitch it in order for it to heal? Well, guess what? That's exactly what happened to this country. We have a huge wound. It's called Donald Trump. It's called the coup. It's called the insurrection. It's called the lies. And before we can do the kumbaya, and before we can sort of say, oh, we shouldn't have a trial in the Senate, you've got to clean out the wound. Otherwise, it festers and grows and it repeats itself. And I think that's what's part of the reason for the trial in the Senate. They can do two things at once. Ask any mother in America about how to multitask, and they will tell you it is very possible. And they can still be effective. But to start hearing people doing the backstroke as a way to protect Joe Biden, I was wild. Bill Curry, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. We are the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We will schmooze on Monday. Take care of yourself, everyone. It's going to be a wild weekend.
You better change.